Officially welcome everyone to today's Clueless Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be helping to moderate our Internet seminar today. Today's session is part of the NARPM Presents seminar series, and we'll have a series of events hosted by NARPM throughout the next few weeks on Clueless, with some additional deliveries to be scheduled later on in the calendar year. Our seminar today will specifically look at closeout procedures for National Priority List sites, and it's been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Our session should run from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern today. We're specifically going to take, again, a look at these closeout procedures, which have been developed for National Priority List sites. And this course has been designed to help RPMs in understanding their requirements for achieving and documenting accomplishments for site closeout. The EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, or OSREDI, has issued an updated version of the Closeout Procedures Guidance in May 2011, and this guidance describes the recommended process for accomplishing and documenting four key milestones for sites on the NPL, and our instructors will go through those resources today. We're going to be joined by two presenters today from the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation, including Catherine Garufi and Nancy Jones. I'm going to cover a couple of housekeeping and reminder items before we kick off the technical portion of the broadcast. And with that, I'm going to ask everybody to move to the very next slide in today's presentation, which is slide number 2, our housekeeping slide. So if you haven't guessed it, we're using the traditional or classic Clueless seminar platform for today's delivery. So each individual attendee will be required to access a copy of the presentation materials and manually advance through the slides at verbal cues from our presenters today. For those of you that have just hopped on the line, I'm on slide number 2, the housekeeping slide. If you haven't downloaded or pulled up a copy of the presentation material, I'm going to refer everyone back to the seminar homepage. When you signed up for today's seminar, you would have received a confirmation email as well as a reminder email from me with information on how to access the seminar homepage. On that homepage, you'd find a complete description of today's session as well as bios and contact information for myself and our two presenters for today's session. On the seminar homepage, there's a link or button to the left side that says Go to Seminar. If you click that, you can check yourself in and actually view the slides online through a web browser window. Alternatively, you can follow links at the bottom of that page to download either a PDF or PowerPoint copy of the slides, and then again, manually move through the materials at verbal cues from our presenters. Those of you that have printed out a copy, simply turn the page. For those of you looking at them through a web browser window, you'll have the option to use the numbered links that appear on the left-hand side of your screen. Again, I'm on slide number 2. Or you can use the orange arrows or icons at the top of the slide. We have a short picture of them up on slide number 2. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the, to the left will move you back one slide. The single arrow to the right will move you forward one slide. This is also a reminder for those of you that are joining us on the teleconference line. We would like everyone to remain on mute. We have already globally muted the phone call, and we would ask that you remain muted to help cut down on background noises. When we get to the point for Q&A, you can unmute by hitting #6, but I would ask that everybody remain muted to help cut down on those disruptions. For those of you streaming audio online or simply looking at the slides in the web browser window, you can actually submit comments and questions at any time. There's no need to wait for a designated break. If you're looking at those icons or buttons on the top, there's one with a question mark in it. If you click that, as long as your pop-up blocker has been disabled, the question mark button will pop up a new window where you can type up your comments, questions, or even report a technical problem at any time. And I'd encourage you to type up your comments and questions as soon as they occur to you so that we can build up a nice, healthy queue. And then when we do take the appropriate break for Q&A, I will read the questions and comments out loud to the presenters so that they may answer them for you. I think I've kind of covered again how we're going to move through the materials. I just want to remind everybody that today's session is being recorded. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to post an archive, and as soon as that archive is available, you will automatically receive an email with the instructions on how you can replay this resource, and you're certainly welcome to forward it on to anyone that you think will find it useful. If you like what we're doing here and you want to take a look at some of our other seminars, we have nearly 500 recorded Internet seminars available on the Clueless Archive page, which is shown at the bottom of slide number 2. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session. So we're going to begin the technical portion for today's broadcast. So we're going to start out with today's closeout procedures for National Priorities List sites on slide number 3. And I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our presenters, again, Catherine Garufi and Nancy Jones from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation.
Thanks, Jean. This is Kate Ferrucci. Nancy, just a little bit of background for everyone before we get started. Nancy Jones and I work in the OSREDI office here in headquarters, and in particular, we're in the construction post-construction management branch. So we deal with anything in the Superfund remedial program from design and construction all the way through site completion and deletion. A little comment on how we sort of want to handle questions and answers. There's going to be four chapters that we're going to do. I, Kate, am going to be doing remedial action completion. Then I'm going to turn it over to Nancy for construction completion. I'm going to cover site completion, and then Nancy will cover deletion. Since there's four chapters, I'd like to, there's a ton of material, so I'd like to move through material as quick as we can, and we're going to break before we start a new chapter and do Q&A at that point. So please, you know, I encourage you again to write any comments that you have and have Jean collect them or save them until the end, write a note to yourself or whatever. Okay, so I'm on slide four right now. This gives us an overview of the actual guidance. It's five chapters. The first chapter is the introduction chapter, which really outlines what you should expect to achieve from review of the closeout procedures guidance. Talks about how it only applies to Superfund National Priorities List sites, although the process may be applicable to other non-National Priorities List sites, such as Superfund Alternative Sites. It talks about how stakeholders, project managers, technical folks, et cetera, can all benefit, and state counterparts can all benefit from review of this guidance. Then Chapter 2 is Remedial Action Completion, which I'm about to cover. Chapter 3, Construction Completion. Chapter 4, Site Completion. Then finally, Chapter 5, Site Deletion and Partial Deletion. On the slide at the bottom, there is a link to the updated 2011 guidance. I encourage folks to take a look at that, perhaps even have it open while we go through the presentation if you'd like to reference it. The presentation closely mirrors the format of the guidance, so it'd be pretty easy to follow and go back and forth if you need to. All right, so I'm moving on to slide five, Chapter 2, Remedial Action Completion. I'm going to skip ahead to slide seven. As Jean noted earlier, the reason that we developed this presentation is in 2011, we updated the then 2000 closeout procedures for National Priority and List sites. So before we do every module within this training, we're going to sort of mention exactly what is new in the 2011 guidance versus what was laid out in the 2000 guidance. So for remedial action completion, the new guidance provides new guidelines on the use of multiple RA or remedial action projects for a single site. This was primarily done to facilitate implementation of the new remedial action project completion program measure for EPA Superfund program. It provides more detail and outline for specific remedial action completion guidelines for multiple types of remedies, and the types of remedies that we're going to cover we'll go into later in this module. And then finally, there was a distinction in the 2000 guidance that talked about interim and final remedial action reports, and we no longer distinguish between an interim and final RA report. We only indicate the need for a remedial action report. And again, the completion guidelines for those will be covered later in the presentation. So I'm moving on to slide eight. So let's start with the definition of what a remedial action is. It is actual construction or implementation of a discrete scope of activities supporting a Superfund cleanup. So again, this is really user-defined, and we'll go into that as we talk about the remedial action completion measure and sort of how the regions who implement our program define that. So on slide nine, operable unit versus remedial action project. For those folks on the line who are familiar with Superfund, historically, when we talk about a site can be small or large. Therefore, for some larger sites, for purposes of dividing them into different areas, we've defined operable units. So operable units or OUs may be a geographic area, contaminated medium, or chronological phase of a cleanup. Again, this is more regionally defined, depends on the site project manager and how they wanted to define an operable unit. Within an operable unit, there may be one or more multiple remedial action or RA projects, and this refers mostly to the physical work carried out at the particular OU. For purposes of the guidance and for the presentation from now on, RA or RA project really mean the same thing. Historically, we've called these construction activities remedial actions, but for when we defined the EPA Superfund measure, we called it an RA project, which I think led to a little bit of confusion. So to try to unconfuse you, we're going to call RA and RA project is the same thing. So sites may have one or more operable unit, and at each of these operable units, you may have one or more remedial action projects. So again, how that site is broken up into operable unit and RA projects really depends on the scope of activities, the nature and extent of contamination, and how the project manager along with management decides best to break that up. So now I'm on slide 10, which I sort of alluded to in the last slide. Multiple RA projects at a site, totally normal. Division of a site into operable units and remedial action projects is at the discretion of the region. We at headquarters do not provide rigorous guidance on how to define remedial actions. We defer to the best professional judgment of the folks in the field. Again, it depends on size and complexity of the project and the site. Each project, regardless of size and complexity, should consist of an appropriate scope of activities which will contribute to the overall effective and efficient cleanup. Some factors to consider when defining projects would perhaps be if you have a combination of federal lead and state lead and PRP lead at a site, it may make sense to have the PRP, which is a responsible party, potentially responsible party, those scope of activities may be one project where you may want to have EPA-funded work as another project. Likewise, we may have non-contiguous areas where the work may be the same, but due to the geographic differences, we may decide to define each area as a different project. And then also, which I think we see more frequently, is different media being different projects. So, for instance, if you have a landfill cap and a groundwater pump and treat system at a site, it may make sense to have the cap as one project and the pump and treat as another project. So we're going to move on to slide 11. Throughout the presentation, we're going to consider a pretty straightforward site scenario and sort of walk through all of these modules and how we would consider, in this case, defining remedial action projects. So the scenario that we're going to use is there is a single site-wide record of decision, which is a legal document defining the remedial decision. In the ROD, we choose cleanup levels and remedial action objectives and define the scope of the work. So in that record of decision, for operable unit 1, which we define as soils, the selected remedy is excavation and off-site disposal. Operable unit 2, which encompasses the contaminated groundwater at the site, the remedy includes in-situ chemical oxidation for on-site groundwater and MNA, or monitored natural attenuation, for the off-site portion of the plume. In conjunction with those technologies, we also chose institutional controls to limit well drilling within that area. All right, so slide 12, remedial action completion. So how do we define completion of these projects? Completion is achieved when the designated EPA regional official, which is a branch chief or above, management above that branch chief, approves the remedial action report. The determination that the work is complete and the timing of the report will depend on the type of work associated with that remedial action. Remedial action, in general, signifies that cleanup levels have been achieved for a given project or RA, except in the case of groundwater or surface water restoration. And I'm going to sort of go into some detail on that in future slides. But before we go into different remedy types and what remedial action completion criteria are, there are other terminologies, which we commonly refer to as the alphabet soup of post-construction, that sort of impact remedial action completion or are done around the same time. These activities are operational and functional, or O&F, long-term response action, or LTRA, PRP long-term response, PRPLR, and operation and maintenance. And the next couple slides are going to really provide an overview of these terminologies. They're not really within the scope of this guidance, but they do occur around the same time as remedial action completion, or their start or complete times are impacted by the definition of a remedial action and the completion requirements. So let's go to slide 14. operational and functional, or ONF, a remedy, or remedial action in this case, becomes ONF either 1 year after physical construction is completed the remedy, or when the remedy, or in this case remedial action, is determined concurrently by EPA and the state to be functioning properly and performing design, whichever is earlier. At some lead sites, the ONF determination sets the schedule for the state to take over responsibility for O&M, or operation and maintenance activities, for that particular remedy. O&M should be well documented. EPA Superfund program has a post-construction website, which I believe is at the end of this presentation. There are links to operational and functional memos that we have that outline these types of documentation expectations. The SSC, or Superfund State Contract, should also outline expectations for operational and functional. As you can tell from this slide, fund lead sites are predominantly where we require ONF per the NCP. However, we encourage regions to also do operational and functional determination at PRP sites. I'm going on to the next slide. Long-term response action, or commonly referred to in our program as LTRA, refers to funds financed groundwater or surface water restoration remedies. It's the 10-year period, or I'll say up to 10-year period, between ONF and O&M, and it's considered to be an extension of the remedial action. So the activities that occur during an LTRA are consistent with operation of a system. However, since the goal of the system is to restore a groundwater or surface water body, we extend the 10-year period for the 90-10 split for paying for the operation and maintenance functions. And that's why it's called long-term response action, and it only occurs for fund lead or EPA financed actions. The 90-10 split, just for folks on the phone that aren't familiar, is the funding split that we generally use for fund lead remedial actions. So if I'm constructing a pump and treat system, EPA anticipates funding 90%, while the state funds 10%. This LTRA period, once that system has been determined to be operational functional, EPA will pay 90% for up to 10 years after we determine it's ONF. PRP, or potentially responsible party lead restoration remedies, are referred to as PRPLR for tracking purposes in our databases. The 10-year frame does not apply, so that activity will occur until the restoration cleanup goals have been met. Again, the operational and functional determination at a restoration remedial action would transition the remedy from remedial action to PRPLR. All right. Slide 16, operation and maintenance. Operation and maintenance, as most folks are probably familiar with, refers to the activities necessary to maintain the effectiveness and integrity of a remedy. This can be monitoring, physical maintenance of an engineered remedy. For restoration remedies, as I alluded to in the last slide, O&M refers to continued operation of the remedy after LTRA. We're going to have some schematics when we talk about different remedy types in later slides, so if this seems a little confusing, we'll have some pictures to try to clarify for folks. Operation and maintenance is conducted by the states or responsible parties, not EPA. The statute precludes EPA from paying for operation and maintenance activities. That's sort of why the statute defined LTRA, so that for these long, in some instances, very long-term time frame remedies, we pay for the first 10 years. I'm going to move on to slide 17. Here's where we get into the weeds on what is remedial action completion for different types of remedies. So, the remedy types that we're going to talk about in the next couple of slides are source remediation actions, source and groundwater containment actions, groundwater and surface water restoration actions, and institutional control actions. So I'm going to move on to slide 18. Source remediation. Source remediation generally refers to actions taken to reduce or eliminate the toxicity, mobility, or volume of contaminated source material. This typically occurs through on-site treatment or by physically removing the waste from the site. An example is excavation, soil vapor extraction, dredging contaminated sediments, stabilization, solidification, and what we see a lot of now, which we haven't seen historically, is DNAPL treatment or treatment of source material in the groundwater through more innovative technologies such as electric resistive heating, steam, or in-situ chemical oxidation. All of these can be source remediation activities. I'm going to move on to the next slide. So how do we determine when remedial actions are complete for source remediation? All construction activities are complete, including any restoration or demobilization activities associated with the technology that you're implementing. All remedial action objectives and cleanup levels for that source remediation have been achieved. A successful contract final inspection has been conducted. And finally, the RA report is consistent with the guidance and has been approved by the designated regional official. Moving on. Here's a pipeline, as I said before, to help visualize this for folks. So the remedial action for source remediation in general, when we're treating source by either removing it or treating it to levels that we determine were protective in the record of decision, we don't generally have an operation and maintenance component or an O&F determination. Remediation means treatment. It does not mean containment. So in this instance, generally the construction is going to address all activities necessary to meet the cleanup levels selected in the record of decision. So I'm going to move on to slide 21. So source containment and groundwater containment is the next category. The difference between source containment and source remediation is when we're containing a source, the expectation is that we're going to need some sort of permanent measure in order to ensure that migration of contaminated source material found at the site does no longer migrate to and impact other media or other areas of the site. So source containment and also groundwater containment. Containment remedies include, as I alluded to before, permanent source control, landfill caps or physical measures to control migration of contaminated groundwater. For instance, we can have slurry walls, hydraulic containment through pump and treat systems. Slide 22. Completion of the remedial action for source and groundwater containment. Like source remediation, all construction activities are complete, including site restoration and demo. All remedial action objectives for the ROD for that remedial action have been achieved. Data indicates that the containment technology that you're utilizing has been achieved and the O&F determination has been made. So if I'm putting in a slurry wall, I would want to have data that indicates that the slurry wall is actually preventing migration of contaminated groundwater or perhaps containment of source material within that area. Number four, successful contract final inspection. And number five, the RA report is consistent with the guidance. Moving on to the next slide, slide 23. Here's a nice schematic for source and groundwater containment. As I alluded to before, these are permanent, generally engineering solutions to contain and prevent mobility of contaminants. Therefore, an operation and maintenance component is generally required for these type of actions. So in this schematic, you will see construction of the containment remedy occurs. Once construction completion happens, the beginning of the one-year operational and functional period occurs. After 1 year, or less than 1 year, depending whichever comes first, it's up to 1 year. That was confusing. I apologize. An O&F determination is made. After an O&F determination is made, a remedial action report is completed. So in general, an O&F determination will occur before the actual documentation for remedial action completion has been drafted and signed by the appropriate official. For source and groundwater containment, after the O&F determination, that remedy will enter the O&M phase. Again, depending on who the lead for the remedy is, PRP or fund, will depend on who takes over O&M. For PRPs, O&M is conducted by the PRP. For fund lead remedies, the remedy would then transition to the state for 100% finance and operation of that containment remedy. Slide 24, groundwater and surface water restoration. This refers to remedies, the objective of returning all or part of the surface water body or affected groundwater aquifer to the beneficial use specified in the ROD. For most groundwaters, given our current guidance, we find that they fall under the current or potential drinking water aquifer. And with implementation of that guidance, that most commonly refers to restoring the plume to drinking water qualities, which may be federal or state MCLs. Because these remedies have historically taken a long period of time to achieve, having remedial action completion for these sites be the attainment of cleanup levels and remedial action objectives didn't make any sense, mostly because the time frame may be as long as 50 to 100 years. So the timing for the RA report for groundwater and surface water restoration remedies is unique. The RA completion occurs shortly after operational and functional, and likely well before the cleanup levels have been achieved. So let's look at a diagram to sort of explain that more thoroughly after we talk about the completion requirements. So on slide 25, the RA completion requirements for restoration remedies of groundwater or surface water, like all the other remedies, the construction of the treatment system is complete. For in-situ remedies to treat an aqueous phase plume, delivery of the appropriate reagent is underway. The monitoring well network is installed. The remedy is operating as intended, or O&S. Contract inspection has been successful, and the RA report has been completed and signed by the official. So let's move on to slide 26. Here's a nice schematic of the groundwater and surface water restoration pipeline. So the remedial action completion would be done very similar to what we would do for a containment remedy. So we would construct the remedy. We would determine that the construction is complete. We would have the O&F period, which is up to a year. And then we would have an O&F determination. Shortly after we determine that the remedy is operational and functional, that physical engineered remedy, we would generally complete the RA report. The O&F determination for a fund lead restoration remedy would then transition into that up to 10 years of long-term response action, or LTRA, where EPA would do the 90-10 funding split with the state. If the remedy after 10 years has still not reached the cleanup levels, it will then go to operation and maintenance, which is 100% responsibility, both fiscally and for maintenance and monitoring, done by the state. For PRP, potentially responsible party, or federal facilities, once we determine that the remedy is operational and functional after constructed, it will go into PRPLR, as I defined earlier, or federal facility world, we call it federal facility operation and maintenance. So, moving on to slide 27. Before I go over slide 27, in general, for remedial action completion, the remedial action objectives selected in the record of decision are going to define how remedial action is completed. So, for any remedial action objective that is for source treatment or containment, achievement of the objectives and any associated cleanup levels are going to drive when remedial action has been completed. If the goal for the remedy or the remedial action being implemented is ultimately to restore the contaminated aquifer to beneficial use, then remedial action completion does not require the attainment of cleanup levels. Instead, it's more driven by actual physical construction. So that's the big takeaway from the different types of remedies. So when we talk about groundwater and surface water restoration, what happened to the interim RA reports was discussed on page 27. As we discussed in the beginning of this training, the 2000 guidance for surface water and groundwater restoration remedies had an interim RA report that was used to document RA completion for restoration remedies. And then it was expected that a final RA report would be issued years later when the cleanup levels had finally been achieved. In practice, the interim label was being used inconsistently and caused some confusion. We were seeing some interim RA reports that were being done for source actions. For example, for a soil vapor extraction system, you would not have an interim RA report. You would only have a final RA report when the system met cleanup levels. However, we were seeing that after the system had been built, people were doing an interim RA report and then doing a final RA report when the system was finally had reached cleanup level. So it was, there was an unnecessary report being generated. The guidance refers to only one RA report per project in this document, and instead of having a final RA report when we achieve the cleanup levels, as we're going to discuss in the third module of this, there's a section of the final closeout report, which is a site completion document, which outlines the data needed to show that the restoration of the surface water or groundwater had been completed. So that's normally what would have been in a final RA report. We've just moved it to a site-wide final closeout report. All right. Slide 28, institutional controls and how they play into remedial action completion. Institutional controls, or ICs for short, are non-engineered instruments, such as administrative or legal controls, that minimize the potential for human exposure to contamination. Or they may protect the integrity of a response action, maintain consistent and protective land use, etc. Examples of ICs you can see here, drilling, zone restrictions, easements, covenants, permits, etc. So slide 29. So the RA completion for a remedial action may depend on how, again, it depends on how the project's defined and how the ICs relate to engineered components. There's primarily three scenarios on how IC implementation may impact RA completion. If the IC implementation party, this is, in many cases, is different from the party construction and the engineered remedy, especially in the fund lead world. For instance, the state may be responsible for the IC implementation and EPA's construction contractors implementing the remedy. We may not include institutional controls in the scope of the remedial action because EPA itself does not really have any control over when those are put in place. In some instances, ICs are fully integrated with engineering components in a single RA project. In some instances, if we have potentially responsible parties who also own the property that these projects are being implemented on, it's a lot easier for, in some instances, for the engineered remedy and these administrative controls to be under one remedial action as defined. And then in some instances, ICs are the sole remedy in a decision document, which is referred to as a limited remedial action. The remedial action completion for an IC-only remedy would be the implementation of the appropriate administrative control. I'm going to move on to slide 30. The closeout procedures touches a little bit on inspections. EPA is contractually required in most instances to conduct pre-final and final inspections to determine whether construction was completed in accordance with design and specification design and specs for that particular remedy. The pre-final inspection is generally done when most of the construction is complete and generates a punch list of items to complete prior to the final inspection. For fund lead projects, the joint pre-final inspection generally initiates the operational and functional up to 1 year period. For PRP and federal facility projects, there's no one way of requiring inspection, so we generally defer to the consent decrees or CDs, administrative orders, and federal facility agreements or FFAs for specifics on those requirements. Again, this guidance doesn't go much into the inspections, but generally recommends pre-final and final inspections to ensure that the contract has been fulfilled. So for slide 31, the RA report. The remedial action report is generally prepared by the construction or oversight constructor or contractor at a site. EPA generally implements construction at their site a number of ways, either through an interagency agreement, through a contract where we contract with a party who then goes out, they do contract oversight management and on-site management. They go out and procure the construction contractor. Or we actually have direct contracts with the constructor. Depending on which scenario we use, we'll generally indicate or dictate who will prepare the report. But as a rule of thumb, EPA generally does not prepare the report. It's generally either an oversight constructor or the constructor themselves. For PRP sites, the PRPs may prepare the report, or in some instances, EPA may have an oversight contractor there who will also prepare the report. The goal for these reports is to submit them within 90 days of the contract final inspection. The approval, there's no EPA headquarters review or concurrence, since it's totally delegated to the regional level. And as we said before, the branch chief or above in the EPA regional office is generally the designated regional official. Once the RA report is signed, the site file is where the original report remains, and copies are submitted to appropriate stakeholders. And per our guidance, we notify natural resource trustees within 1 week of the approval. So slide 32 talks about the RA report contents. these are generally pretty general. There's nothing too crazy in here. It's really just looking to have a report to document all of the construction activities that were done in conjunction with the contract and the scope of work under which the contract was given. Background for the site, general construction activities, site chronology of events, performance specifications, standards, and construction quality control. This would also, for any source control remedies, probably have data in there, confirmatory sampling, et cetera. A section on final inspection and certifications, a list of any operation and maintenance activities, perhaps also a reference to an operation and maintenance manual, and then contact information and appendices. Nothing crazy there. So let's revisit our training scenario on slide 33. So for a single site-wide record of decisions, we have two operable units with a couple different technologies to implement both source remediation and groundwater restoration. So for the soil, we have excavation and off-site disposal. That activity seems like a discrete scope of activities related to one specific media at the site. So if I were to break this up, I would probably define that as one remedial action. For the groundwater, there's really two ways that we can handle this. First, the groundwater is being addressed through a combination of what I would call active treatment, which is the in-situ chemical oxidation for on-site groundwater, and a more passive technology, which is monitored natural attenuation, where we're not actually implementing anything, we're depending on intrinsic properties within the aquifer. So depending on how we would want to handle this, we could either have one remedial action, which included the in-situ chemical oxidation and monitored natural attenuation, or in some instances, we may decide that we would do a remedial action for the in-situ chemical oxidation and have a separate remedial action for the monitored natural attenuation. We may do this for a couple of reasons. Perhaps the on-site remedy is being implemented by a responsible party, and the M&A or off-site remedy is not being implemented by a responsible party. Therefore, it may be appropriate to have two remedial actions. If that's the case, they may also be on different schedules, which is why you might want to do them differently. The institutional control to limit well drilling. If this was a fund lead project, I would probably not include the institutional controls for remedial action completion if they were being implemented by another party. If EPA had some control on institutional control implementation and did not think that implementation would delay remedial action completion, you may have a site-specific conclusion to include them. Again, it really depends on what you want to do. So for purposes of moving forward, let's say the remedial action completion for soil is RA1 and remedial action 2 is the in-situ chemical oxidation for on-site groundwater. Remedial action 3 will be the M&A portion. So, for remedial action completion of OU1 or RA1 for the soils, the RA completion would be declared when excavation activities had been done, any backfilling that was necessary was completed, and any restoration activities, seeding, et cetera, had been completed. For OU2 groundwater, for the remedial action 2 or the on-site groundwater portion, remedial action completion would be done when the network for chemical delivery had been constructed and the first round of reagents had been delivered. It would then go into LTRA, or long-term response action, for up to 10 years. For OU2 groundwater, monitored natural attenuation, we would determine RA completion when the monitoring well network had been constructed. Once we had determined that those wells had been constructed, it would transfer to long-term response action for the off-site portion for up to 10 years. All right. And I am done with that section. So, Jean, I'm going to open it up to any questions that you might have.
Okay. So just a reminder for those of you that are viewing the slides online, if you click the question mark icon at the top of the slides, as long as your pop-up blocker is disabled, you can type them up electronically. We do have a number of questions that have already been typed up electronically, and I'm going to go ahead and just start reading through some of them. I think you kind of already touched upon this, but one of our participants mentioned or asked if there was a quick reference guide that was specifically listing or calling out the updates in the 2011 update to this guidance.
No. Short answer. One of the reasons, for background for folks, one of the reasons that we did this training when it came out, I will admit, I know there's non-EPA and state people that are on the phone, but it was predominantly geared towards EPA folks to sort of explain what the differences were. But no, there's no quick reference guide. Short answer.
Okay, great. And then another participant, and I think you've highlighted a lot of the acronyms. You've already kind of talked about them, but they want to know if there's a place where they can find a running list or glossary for all of the terms that are being used in the presentation.
As a matter of fact, there are. If you guys click on the 2011 guidance link that was on slide 5, I think, it was like my first or second slide, on the 1, 2, 3, 3rd page, 4th page, there is an acronym slide. There's also, if you Google Superfund acronyms, I think you can actually get a master list, which is above and beyond what's needed for this guidance.
Excellent. Let's see. I'm going to go through. I've got a couple more here in the queue. I think we've got time to go through a few more. Our next participant would like to know, if you close out some OUs before others, can you still get a site closure, or do you need all OUs to be considered, quote, closed before the site itself is closed?
We will get to that later. Short answer, everything needs to be done. So remedial action completion in the can be done at any point during the lifetime of the site, I guess, remediation cycle. So we may have remedial actions that are completed, we may have sites that are still on the MCL that had remedial actions completed 15 years ago. In order to be done, we need to have remedial actions completed and cleanup levels achieved for every remedial action selected in a record of decision. But again, we will beat that dead horse later. So.
Okay, great. Another user would like to know, and this is in reference to the funding split between states and EPA from the fund lead status. When EPA sues for cost recovery from RPs, do the states get 10% of those costs to represent their 10% share of funding for cleanup?
That's a great question. I don't know. I would have to defer to our enforcement folks on that. So I can't answer that. I'm sorry.
No problem. That's okay. That is all right. We also have another member from Baltimore, Maryland, who would like to know if there is an RA report template that they should be pointing their support contractors to.
There is not a template. The guidance has an outline. Since the 2000 guidance had been in, I guess we have been implementing it for 12 years, there are a lot of examples. We actually streamlined the RA report from what was in the 2000 guidance. The 2000 guidance had stuff in there related to costs and lessons learned, which we took out. So I would use the outline in the guidance, the 2011 guidance, which is on page 2-12 through 2-14. It's a pretty comprehensive outline. I'd use that as a starting point.
Okay, great. And then the last online question that I have is coming in from Downington, Pennsylvania, and they would like to know, is it possible to suspend or terminate elements of activities in the O&M phase if that particular element or activity is no longer needed to meet the attainment of the RAOs in the ROD? And if so, how do you do that?
Well, that's a broad question. There are instances where you may be able to, I would say, if we're talking about groundwater restoration, there may be instances where we need a more, let's say, take the old pump and treat example. So if we build a pump and treat system and we've got, I don't know, it's a huge plume, we've got 40 extraction wells, and as we continue to remediate the plume and decrease the footprint, we find that we might only need 3 extraction wells. That's totally fine. That's part of operation and maintenance and adaptive management to changing site conditions. The record of decision process, if you wanted to change the technology, you may have to go through the legal ROD or record of decision process but there's no, I guess, you know, if you're using a technology to achieve a cleanup level and you've met the cleanup level, you can justify no longer needing the technology. If you're trying to terminate a technology before a cleanup level has been met, I wouldn't say that we preclude, we can't do that, but you may, again, it's site specific as to what you're going to have to do next. So I can't really broad brush answer that. I would say shoot me an email with the site specific question and I'll answer it for you.
Okay, great. And we will cover how to get access to your contact information before we close out today. So thank you very much. Let's just check real quickly. If anybody's on the telephone lines and you have a question, you can hit #6 to take yourself off of mute and ask a question out loud if you like. Okay, I don't hear any questions coming in on the phone line, so Kate, please feel free to continue. We left off on slide number 34.
Yes, and we're going to go to slide 35, and I'm going to pass the mic to Nancy Jones for this section.
So we are going to move on to slide 36, and we're going to be talking about construction completion in this section. And as you know, one of the questions alluded to earlier, there is a difference between construction completion, which is site-wide, and the RA completion. They're very different. On the one hand, the bar for construction completion is higher because you can't achieve it until the last project is constructed. On the other hand, the bar for construction completion is much lower because punch list items are allowed to linger and cleanup goals don't have to be achieved. You just have to have constructed everything on site but not have met your cleanup goal. The best way to separate them in your mind is and consult the guidance, or you can call us at headquarters you know, when you're considering whether you've achieved a milestone or not. So moving on to slide 37, what's new about the 2011 guidance? Well, we have additional details about in-situ remedies in this guidance versus the previous guidance. We did have an addendum which provided that information, but we wanted to further clarify it here so because it's such a common technology. So that's one of the changes. Additionally, we also removed the requirement for cost information in the preliminary closeout report. So moving on to slide 38. What is the definition of construction completion? As the slide says, a construction completion site is a surplus site where physical construction of all cleanup action is complete, including actions to address all immediate threats and to bring all long-term threats under control. So I want to emphasize that this is site-wide. So site-wide, all the physical construction activities are completed and the long-term threats are under control, but not cleaned up. So you don't have to have met your cleanup goal. Moving on to slide 39. Just to give you a little background about how, you know, why we created this measure. Early on in the program, in the Superfund program, site deletion, meaning removing site from the national priority list, was our key measure of cleanup success. But most sites take many years to be able to be deleted from the national priority list. So construction completion was created as an interim measure to more clearly communicate progress that's being achieved at the site. And just to, you know, let you know what our current status is, at the end of our fiscal year 2012, the Superfund program had completed 1,144 construction completion sites. So that's just kind of let you know where we stand now. Currently, construction completion is not a primary measure for us anymore, but it's as far as what we report to Congress. But it still serves as a key measure. So we still do track our number of construction completions. So moving on to slide 40, you know, what is the construction completion process composed of? You don't have to have achieved operations and functional status or RA completion of all of your RA projects prior to construction completion. As I mentioned, you just have to have, physical construction needs to be completed. And so once you have that, then you conduct a pre-final inspection of the last of the RA construction at the site, review your punch list items, and there should just be minor modifications that are necessary, nothing that affects the functionality. Review all the considerations for specific remedial technologies addressed by the guidance, and then preparing your preliminary closeout report. There are some instances where a final closeout report can be done in lieu of preliminary closeout report, but we're going to talk about that later. So, moving on to slide 41. Technology considerations. This section of the guidance provides information and recommendations for achieving construction completion for a given remedy, assuming that the given remedy is the last action of the site prior to achieving construction completion. Some examples that are in the guidance are groundwater treatment, soil vapor extraction, in-situ remedies for groundwater or soil, monitoring, institutional controls, interim remedies, and contingency remedies. And we're going to talk about each of these individually. So moving on to slide 42, we're going to talk about the guidelines for groundwater treatment remedies. You have physical construction of the treatment plant, pumps, extraction, wells completed, done the initial monitoring network for monitored natural attenuation, conducted your pre-final inspection, treatment system is operational, and you can expect, some minor future adjustments, but they should be minimal. And the preliminary closeout report identifies an anticipated date of the operation and function determination and estimated time frame to achieve all the various goals. Moving on to slide 43. Soil vapor extraction guidelines. Here's an example of when your RA completion would potentially occur much later than construction completion. If the soil vapor extraction is the last remedy at your site, you are construction complete when it's built and turned on. But the RA completion would not occur until the cleanup levels are achieved in the soil. So that's just a difference in, how you determine construction completion versus RA completion for that technology. Moving on to slide 44, in-situ remedies for groundwater or soil. Some examples of in-situ remedies are in-situ oxidation, biological treatment, thermal, air sparging, permeable reactive barriers, are just to name a few. This usually involves adding treatment agents to the subsurface. It could include chemical agents like oxidants or surfactants, agents to facilitate microbial activity, heating agents, physical reactants, that type of thing being added. So in 2005, we put out an addendum to our previous guidance for in-situ remedies, as I mentioned previously, which has now been fully incorporated into this updated 2011 closeout procedures guidance. And I just want to emphasize that once the full-scale remedy is underway, the key is for physical construction of at least the first phase of the remedy to be completed. So once you have the first phase, full-scale remedy, then you can declare construction completion after the first phase. So those types of activities can include, turning the power on, commencement of the steam generation, first in round of injection of the treatment agent, that type of thing. All right, moving on to slide 45. Guidelines for groundwater monitoring. For the need for a monitoring does not preclude considering a site construction fleet if the site qualifies otherwise. So for modern natural attenuation remedies, the initial network of monitoring wells should be in place prior to the construction completion declaration. Monitored natural attenuation can be very dynamic and lots of changes, so there could be a need to install additional monitoring wells later on after the CC determination, but that's something to be expected. So monitoring is going to be a continued activity, and that's a given. So moving on to slide 46, guidelines for institutional controls. Institutional controls require no physical construction. So it can be achieved before the institutional controls are in place. So IC should be documented in a decision document, meaning the record of decision that Kate mentioned earlier, and the preliminary closeout report should detail all the future implementation of all the institutional controls. And the institutional controls need to be implemented in order to achieve the final site completion. That's going to be the next chapter that Kate's going to talk about. So keep that in mind, that they don't have to be in place for construction completion, but they do need to be in place for site completion. Moving on to slide 47. Interim remedies are commonly used to institute temporary measures where a final remedial solution is developed. Generally limited in scope and will subsequently be addressed by a final record of decision. But there should be a final record of decision and implementation of final remedy before the site qualifies as construction complete. So temporary measures can be used to evaluate performance of the technology before setting final cleanup goals, but interim rods must be finalized before construction completion. So that's just a rule of thumb. Slide 48. Sites with contingency remedies may be considered CC in some examples. For example, if DNA is used for groundwater, that there had been a contingency for pump and treat, but it seems not necessary. The region has enough information, they've got data to support the fact that the modern natural attenuation is working, they don't need to do the pump and treat, and they document that in the preliminary closeout report, that the contingency remedy is not anticipated, then a CC determination can be made. And there does not need to be an amended record of decision. If for some reason later on the contingency has to be invoked, then that's okay. It doesn't preclude doing that additional work, but you should be fairly confident at the data to support it at the time that you don't need to invoke the contingency.
Nancy, before you go any further, is there any way you can get a little closer to the speakerphone mic? We've got one or two people that are having a hard time hearing you.
Okay.
Moving the mic.
All right. The mic is closer now. Hopefully that's
much better. That works. Thank you.
All right. Not a problem. Okay. So I'm on slide 49 now. And so we're going to be covering the lead and authority considerations. So for PRP lead sites, the CC determination should not affect any enforcement agreement or other obligations of PRPs. The construction completion criteria for PRP, meaning potentially responsible party, is identical to the criteria for fund lead sites. For federal facilities, the construction completion procedures are identical to the fund lead and the potentially responsible party lead sites.
typically the preliminary closeout reports for federal facilities are longer than they are for the fund lead or PRP lead sites because of the size and complexity of federal facility sites. However, generally, most of the EPA RPMs develop the preliminary closeout reports, and they don't have to be, you know, super long. They're a little bit longer for federal facilities, 20 pages, and for the fund lead and PRP, more like 9 to 12. So, but generally they are done, unlike the RA reports, who are done by contractors, as Kate mentioned, for the preliminary closeout reports. Those are typically done by EPA or the state if it's a state lead site. So on to the next slide, slide 50. As I just mentioned, for state lead sites, usually the state prepares the preliminary closeout report and EPA concurs. If the state doesn't prepare it, then it's the EPA remedial project manager's responsibility. If the site is done under removal authority, the construction completion can be documented by a final closeout report rather than just a preliminary closeout report. And if the site is a mix of removal and remedial authority, then you just need to make sure that all the removal actions are described in the preliminary closeout report. If multiple authorities are used, like, for example, in addition to CERCLA, if RCRA or another government authority is used, then you only have to cover the CERCLA pieces, the Superfund pieces, in the preliminary closeout report. So moving on to slide 51, achieving construction completion at deleted sites. There are certain circumstances where sites may be deleted from the national priority list upon deferral to RCRA, which is the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. Physical construction is not likely to be complete at the time of deletion, is one thing to keep in mind. These deleted deferred sites are eligible for CC when all the physical construction under all the authorities is complete. So as a result, the CC may follow deletion at a small number of sites. It doesn't happen very often, but it is possible. Additional work. It is possible to do additional work at construction completed sites, such as routine adjustments. Are really common. Repairs, cap maintenance, occasional new monitoring wells, as we mentioned. However, the construction completion would be premature if substantial construction is necessary later on. So really need to evaluate that at the time that you're considering construction completion about whether or not you foresee doing very much substantial additional work. All right, moving on to slide 53. So once all the physical construction is completed and the report has been prepared, again, typically by the EPA remedial project manager, as I mentioned, it's 7 to 9 pages. This says sometimes I've seen them to be like 10, and then for federal facilities, longer, more like 20. Then they are sent to EPA headquarters regional coordinator to be reviewed and assessed for CC eligibility. And so the EPA headquarters person reviews the draft and provides comments and concurrence on the final draft. And once that has all occurred, then the regional remedial project manager sends it through their own concurrence process. Well, ultimately it would be signed by the Superfund division director in that region or their designee, and then it would be sent to headquarters once it's signed to be input into CERCLIS, we do that. We do the flipping the flag and CERCLIS for the regions once the report has been signed off at the regional level. And the regional folks, though, retain the original copy in the site file and submit any copies to necessary stakeholders. And then the RPM, the remedial project managers, need to notify the natural resource trustees within 1 week of signature. Okay. What are the contents of the preliminary closeout report? That can be found in our guidance document that Kate mentioned earlier. It's Exhibit 3-2 in our guidance, which outlines kind of a template kind of thing of what's in a PCOR, a preliminary closeout report. We have copies of all preliminary closeout reports that have been completed and can share examples at any time. So if anybody wants to see a recent example of one, from, a specific state, then that you can contact me and I can provide that to you. The type of information that we like to see in the introduction section includes the pre-final inspection date, make an affirmative statement that parties have reached, have constructed all remedies in accordance with design plans and specifications, and the summary of site condition section. We look for site background information, information about any removals that are conducted, the selected remedies, and remedial action objectives, the dates and details of implementing each remedy, what was actually done, not just what the record of decision selected. Under the demonstration of construction of quality assurance, quality control section, we look for a description of how the construction was consistent with the QAQC plan and if there were any deviations. In the schedule of activities for site completion, the types of things that should be in there should be information about the operation functional activities, operation and maintenance, institutional controls, anticipated dates for achieving cleanup goals, the five-year review, the schedule, who's responsible and when for each of these items. Finally, as I mentioned at the beginning, costs are no longer needed in the preliminary closeout report. So that section just isn't necessary anymore. All right, moving on to slide 55, which is our training scenario again. As we talked about before in OU1, for the soil to have reached construction completion for OU1, you need to have done all the excavation and off-site disposal, very similar to the RA completion. For OU2, for groundwater, you would have needed to done the first round of in-situ chemical oxidation for on-site groundwater restoration, modern natural attenuation of off-site groundwater restoration, and institutional controls to limit well drilling. So for the groundwater, installation of injection wells and any piping needed, again, at least one injection done, conducted the pre-final inspection, show that it's performing as designed, monitoring wells are in place and being used to do the monitoring. So, again, just the first phase in place. And then, as I mentioned, for the ICs, they don't need to be implemented, but they should be described in that preliminary closeout report with specifically mentioning the schedule of activities for site completion. Okay, so now I'm ready for questions for this section.
Okay, great. Again, just a reminder, if you want to submit your questions electronically, you may click that question mark icon at the top of the slides and type them up. And we'll also take a quick pause to see if anybody on the phone lines has a question. We do have two that have already been typed up electronically, though, so I'll start with those. And
go ahead. The
first one is going to come in from Maryland. And it actually looks like we have a federal partner who's asking if there is a document that crosswalks EPA and the DOD or Department of Defense lingo.
This is Kate. I think we would have to ask, I'm assuming the person's referring to, we call remedial action reports, RA reports, and I think the federal facilities call them RACRs. I think federal facilities, DOD put out a guidance, I think, that mirrored ours for closeout, which talked about their different site completion phases. We don't have one, but we could, again, if somebody wants to put that in a comment on the review forms or whatever, we can probably, we have a federal facility office in pretty much the same building, so I'm sure we could ask them.
Okay, great. Thank you. And our next question is also coming in from Downington, Pennsylvania, and they ask if RA completion, CC completion, et cetera, were reached and approved, applying the older guidance, is there anything in the new guidance that would constitute reopening the site?
If the site has reached remedial action, the question's hard without a little bit more context. If the site is construction completion and all the RA reports are done, it may just be in long-term operation and maintenance to achieve long-term restoration goals. So for purposes of RA reports and CC reports or CC determinations, we generally don't reopen CC determinations. They're generally just a one-time site-wide determination. Related to RA reports, in a lot of situations, I don't want to say a lot of situations, that sounds bad, but, you know, the program's been in place since the early 80s, and there are some situations where we've declared construction completion and perhaps a maximum MCL and groundwater has changed, and we've needed to update the remedy, and we've done an amended decision. And if we've had to put a new technology in place, we've just done a new RA report for that new technology if we've done it. So we've done more RA reports, but we don't generally retroactively open old ones.
Well, I think they're asking specifically, though, if the new version of the guidance caused anything to have to be reopened, and I don't think that is the case. The new guidance just provided some additional clarifications and provided the information about the new measure. Right. But it would not have changed any site status.
Okay, great. Thank you very, very much. So let's check quickly to see if anybody on the telephone lines has a question. If you're on the phone lines, you'll want to hit, #6 to unmute. Okay, I don't hear anybody on the phone lines. I don't see anything else typed up. If we are in the middle of typing up your question, don't worry. Go ahead and continue and finish, and we'll be sure to take time before the entire session closes out to ask any other questions we have in the queue. So with that, I think I'm going to go ahead and turn things back. Are we switching back over to Kate now?
Yep.
Slide 57.
Okay. Let's move up to slide 58. We are now going into site completion, so I can answer some of those questions that folks alluded to earlier with closeout. I would say for folks, site closeout is analogous to site completion for purposes of milestones in the remedial program under Superfund. So on 58, I see a typo, but this is a site completion, like construction completion, is not remedy specific. We look at all the remedial actions at the site, but we make one site-wide determination. The document for site completion is the final closeout report, which is going to look and smell a lot like the PCOR, but it's going to have some additional information in it. So let's go to slide 59. So what's new from the 2011 guidance? The 2000 guidance for site completion was very vague, which some would argue was helpful, some would argue was not. But we needed to provide more clarification for both our RPMs and our state counterparts and our PRP universe to ensure that we were consistently applying site completion across the board. The FCOR section, the final closeout report, or I'm going to refer to it as FCOR, my short lingo from now on, we added a section in this document to discuss both confirmatory sampling events for source remediation and containment, which would have been in the remedial action reports, and we also put a new section in
to discuss data to support attainment of the groundwater or surface water restoration remedial action objectives and cleanup levels. So, as I alluded to before in the RA section, we had for groundwater restoration, we had an interim RA report, which is when it was built, and then a final RA report when it was eventually done. So this new section in the FCOR about the attainment is really taking the meat of what we would have put in the final RA report and just putting it in the site-wide document. Since in general, groundwater and surface water restoration is the activity that lags and generally holds up site completion. So we figured this would be a better place to put it. So slide 60. What is site completion? It's the end of all response actions at an MPL site. So before I go to slide 61, for purposes, the MCP sort of defines response as any activity, we could say remedial or removal, that's taken at a site to achieve a remedial action, I guess, or associated cleanup level. So you can meet site completion and still have ongoing activities at the site that I'm going to cover earlier. So as we move forward, just think about the completion of response actions, meaning that I have met all the goals and all the cleanup levels in my decision document. So slide 61 is the site completion criteria. The first bullet is that all remedial decision documents have been completed, and the selected remedy in these decision documents is consistent with CERCLA, our statute, the NCP, National Contingency Plan, which are our regs, and all EPA policy and guidance under which we implement the statute and the regs. So this is really a pretty loaded statement, and it was done on purpose, and we'll talk about it in a little bit, and it's really just providing a bar that we expect sites to meet in order to show that they are protective. Because ultimately, the goal of the Superfund program is to be protective of human health and the environment. So that's sort of what our site completion criteria is. So the second bullet is that all response actions have been completed. Again, response is remedial removal and appropriately documented in the site file. And then finally, the institutional controls finally come into play. So institutional controls need to be in place and enforceable, and before we can do site completion. So the next slides, we're going to go really into more detail here as to what these bullets mean. So I'm going to go to slide 62. So now we're going to talk a little bit about that bullet, the first one, the loaded statement, as I alluded to earlier. The first bullet says, all actions taken at the site are generally documented in a remedial decision document. That means that all remedial actions are generally selected through the Superfund ROD process, so they've gone through the 9 criteria, or the original decision has been amended through a ROD amendment, which also takes remedy selection through the 9 criteria, or through an ESD or site memo. This is because these documents are considered the legal documents which are defining what protective remedial action objectives and cleanup levels are. So all the activities that are taken in a site, we recommend they're generally documented in decision documents. And we have, under our Superfund website, plenty of guidance on remedy decisions that ultimately drives site completion. Second bullet, all cleanup actions taken under another authority evaluated in a CERCLA decision document before completion. So in some instances, this sort of gets at some removal actions. Sometimes at sites we'll take removal actions, and these are generally done earlier in the site, I guess, site lifetime, but not necessarily. But what we generally recommend is that a remedial decision document completed at the site incorporates the removal activities, particularly if a removal activity kept waste in place that did not allow for unlimited use of that media that it addressed. And that the reason we want them in a CERCLA decision document is so that we, through the 9 criteria process, can institute the 5-year review, the 5-year review process, as well as perhaps document O&M operation maintenance requirements and any ICs that may be necessary. At other sites, in some instances, we may have states that would like to implement portions of a remedial action that was selected in a decision document, that was not selected in a decision document, so they may want to take actions under state authority. If that If the actions are done on the CERCLA release that we are addressing under Superfund, then we ultimately need to document what was done and ensure that it's protective under Superfund. So really, at the end of the day, through the Superfund CERCLA decision document process, we'd like to go through our remedy selection process to make sure that everything that was done at the site meets protective, meets our threshold of being protective of human health and the environment. The third bullet, evaluate whether response actions adequately address all contamination and exposure pathways identified during the RIFS and subsequent site characterization. This bullet gets at perhaps any new exposure pathways that may come up. The one that just comes to mind is the vapor intrusion pathway. So we would want to make sure at the time of site completion that if we have contaminants left on site above levels that are that allow for unrestricted use, so you may have some O&M requirement, there may be some containment, that the vapor intrusion into buildings type scenario has been properly considered. It doesn't necessarily have to be addressed through some sort of remedy, but we've at least considered it. And then finally, remedy decisions are consistent with EPA policy and guidance. That's particularly relevant to groundwater remedies and institutional controls. For instance, in general, if we, upon achieving site completion, we have some contaminant left on site above levels that allow for unrestricted use, we generally are going to require some institutional controls in conjunction with operation and maintenance to ensure that the integrity of the containment remedy or perhaps a restricted land use remains consistent so that it remains protective of human health and the environment, and we'll evaluate those through the 5-year review process. So we would want the institutional controls necessary to prohibit certain uses and or protect the integrity of a remedy to be in a CERCLA decision document. And then for groundwater remedies, we have a lot of guidance in Superfund on expectations for groundwater remediation and, in particular, restoration. So if the groundwater at the site is considered, for instance, a current or future drinking water use, then in general, our guidance recommends MCLs being a cleanup level for beneficial use in most scenarios. So we would want to make sure that the remedy selected is consistent with our groundwater remedy selection and use policy. So that's pretty generic, but it sort of gives us an ability to, again, sort of set a bar for protectiveness based on how we select remedies, and we can evaluate all records of decision depending if they were written, as, again, our programs have been in place since the 80s, so our sophistication in both writing remedies and technologies has improved, and our guidance, our guidance continues to be updated. So we just want to make sure that all the decisions that were made many years ago are still consistent with the guidances that we're putting out today. Because, again, ultimately, we want to be protective of human health and environment, and that's what the purpose of this particular bullet is. So I'm going to go to slide 63. All response actions have been documented in the site file and completed. This is really just saying the documentation, whether it's our remedial action reports or subsequent monitoring reports, have defensible data, reportable data, to verify that cleanup levels associated with particular responses have been achieved. So in source remediation, if I was doing bioremediation of a source area, I would want to look at the remedial action report and see that there was confirmatory sampling within that soil media to ensure that I met the cleanup levels in the rod. Also, for instance, for groundwater restoration, I would want to make sure that I have data to indicate that I have restored the aquifer and addressed the contaminated plume sufficiently. So again, remedial action reports for remedial actions and pull reps or pollution reports for removals are really what we're sort of looking for as the basis for demonstrating that every remedial action is done. So slide 64, institutional controls are in place. All institutional controls must be implemented before site completion. And as I talked about before, IC should be considered for all response actions that upon completion or achievement of those remedial action objectives and cleanup levels that leaves waste in place, we should have an IC. And then, as I discussed before, the IC requirements that we're depending on for long-term protectiveness should be in a CERCLA decision document. Slide 65, the role of operation and maintenance in achieving site completion.
So again, I set the bar for site completion as being the completion of all response activities. So if an operation and maintenance activity is continuing at a site that has already achieved the objectives and cleanup levels in the record of decision, that O&M does continue after site completion. So in this case, it would be perhaps if we chose a remedy at a site that was a landfill cap and leachate collection, we would decide that the site was complete when the cap was in place, functioning as intended, and the leachate collection system was adequately collecting and or controlling the plume from the landfill. So O&M is going to occur in perpetuity at the site, and that's fine if the role of the operation and maintenance is to continue to maintain a remedy, in most instances, a containment remedy, for purposes of meeting future containment goals. Any site with O&M activities being conducted in a continued effort to achieve objectives and cleanup levels, it's premature to determine that a site's complete. Two examples here, sediment remedies. If I decide to do a dredging and then monitor natural recovery of sediments, although I had completed construction by completing my dredging and now I'm just going out and monitoring either sediment in situ, which would be in the water body, or I'm looking at another pathway like fish tissue, because my cleanup level is a fish tissue level, if I continue to do O&M to meet those cleanup levels but I haven't met them yet, I'm not ready to determine that the site is complete and do an F-core. Likewise, for groundwater, if I have a trichloroethylene plume and my contaminant concentrations in the aquifer continue to be above the 5 part per billion cleanup level, that I continue to do operation maintenance and monitoring to try to meet that goal, but since I haven't met it yet, site completion is premature. So really, you can have operation and maintenance at a site. It just depends on what the purpose of the operation maintenance is and whether or not it is to achieve an initial cleanup level, or it is to continue to meet one. And I hope that does not confuse people. Okay, so slide 66, final closeout report outline. Sub-bullet, the number one and number two, introduction and summary of site conditions, is really going to be a copy and paste from the preliminary closeout report, probably, unless anything dramatic has happened. Number three, or Roman numeral three, is the monitoring results. And in this section, we're really going to talk about any monitoring that's been done since perhaps a containment activity was done to continue to ensure that some sort of, again, physical or hydraulic containment continues to be operating to meet the remedial action objectives. Also, in the monitoring section, we're also going to talk about any confirmatory sampling from source actions to show that source treatment has met the cleanup levels selected in the record of decision. Section 4 is what I was alluding to before as the section that sort of replaces the final remedial action report for surface water groundwater restoration remedies. So in this section, we're going to talk about, it says attainment of groundwater restoration cleanup levels, and that's because generally most of our restoration remedies are groundwater. We have a couple surface water restoration remedies, but predominantly they're groundwater, so, you know, if you had a surface water remedy, you could just change that word. In this section, you want to provide adequate data and append the data to the back to really provide the story from inception of, you know, construction of the engineered remedy through achievement of cleanup levels to really justify that the plume that you selected that remedy for has been remediated to those protective levels. Section 5, summary of operation and maintenance, is really talking about any operation and maintenance activities, again, that are going to be needed once the site has been deemed complete to ensure that any containment components, including institutional controls, remain in place and are effective. Demonstration of cleanup activity, quality assurance, quality control, that's the same as construction completion, really, same premise. The next section, section seven, is the five-year review section. In that section, we'd like to talk about whether a five-year review is required. In general, if waste continues to be left in place above levels that would allow for unrestricted use, we require five-year reviews in perpetuity. So if you have O&M going on forever, you're generally going to have a five-year review. So in this section, we'd like to talk about perhaps if there was a five-year review that's already been done at the site, what the findings of the last one were, and when the next one's happening. And then Roman numeral 8, site completion criteria, really just is a section to make the statement that the criteria, the three criteria we discussed in the beginning of this chapter have been met, and provide a little site-specific information as to why. So it's really just bolstering your case, making your argument. All right, so slide 67. Like the P-Corps preliminary closeout report, the final closeout report is a summary of all activities done at the site. Information should be taken from remedial action reports, the P-Corps monitoring reports, records of decision. It's typically prepared by the EPA RPM. It's summary in nature. It may be a little longer than the preliminary closeout report, and that's because we have, for groundwater restoration remedies, we may have some appendices, including some data tables, as well as that section that talks about those monitoring results for both source remediation and groundwater restoration. So for the approval and review process, EPA headquarters reviews final closeout reports by the regional coordinator, who's in our construction post-construction management branch, who review them. And the final closeout report is signed by the regional administrator, or it may be delegated to someone such as the division director in the region. Once the document's signed, it's retained in the site file, sent to stakeholders. It's the same as every other document we've talked about on this presentation. I have a little note down there on the bottom. It's recommended that regions work with headquarters to resolve all site issues at the time of the final closeout report. If you guys noticed, headquarters does not have a concurrence role, like sort of an informal concurrence role like we have on P-Corps for construction complete, and we don't have them for the final closeout report, but as Nancy's going to talk about in the deletion section, headquarters does have a concurrence role on deletions, and the final closeout report is the document that's really the basis for site deletion. So if any issues, whether it's amount of information or some policy questions that headquarters may come back with after review, it's recommended that these issues be resolved at the time of the final closeout report, because if we don't resolve them at this point, we're going to have to resolve them at the deletion point. So I always say, get it early. All right. So slide 68, we're going to revisit our training scenario. We did all our RA reports for soil and groundwater. We determined it was construction completion. It's been operating. We've been monitoring. And we finally found out that groundwater has met the restoration MCL, federal or state. So the site-wide determination would be made when all the following have occurred. The excavation and off-site disposal for soils has been completed. All restoration activities have been done, and confirmatory sampling indicates that the soil has met the cleanup levels in the decision document. For the groundwater remedy, of course, the remedy has been constructed and implemented, and all aquifer monitoring data has indicated that the groundwater has been restored for those contaminants of concern and met the associated cleanup levels selected in the record of decision. And in the case of a final closeout report, institutional controls to limit well drilling do not necessarily have to remain in place, because in this situation, if the soil was being excavated to residential levels or protective groundwater levels, so we determined upon completion of all of these activities that unrestricted use was appropriate for the area, then the institutional controls to limit well drilling, although were necessary for protectiveness during the groundwater remediation, are no longer necessary if we've met our cleanup levels and it's been restored to beneficial use. So you would want to talk about the ICs in the final closeout report, but for purposes of completing a site, these ICs no longer have to remain in place. So based on site-specific conditions, you may decide that the IC can remain. For some reason, the state wants to use it, but EPA no longer requires it under CERCLA at the site if the groundwater is being restored to beneficial use. All right. Slide 69. I'm done with that. Does anyone have any questions?
We did actually have a clarifying question that came in regarding their earlier question about the differences between DOD terminology and EPA terminology. And that participant mentioned that P-Corps was referenced as being used prior to determining O and F, yet later was used to document CC. And this seems to be very different phases in the remedial process. So can you explain that any further?
The P-Corps... Okay, so can you repeat that one more time?
Absolutely. So the exact question says, PCOR was referenced as being used prior to determining ONF, yet later was used to document CC. This seems to be very different phases in the remedial process. Can you explain those differences any further?
Okay. So let's talk about operational and functional if it is the last remedy at the site to be constructed, because construction completion is site-wide. So we can't determine construction completion measure on a site-wide level until every remedy has been determined construction complete. So let's say the last remedy at the site is a pump and treat system. the bar for construction complete is less than the bar for ONF. So for construction completion, the pump and treat system needs to be on and water needs to be running through it. So construction completion can generally happen at if the last remedy, when we do the pre-final inspection for the last remedy. So if the last remedy is pump and treat, we've built the system, we go do a pre-final inspection. Now, conversely, for ONF at that particular remedy, the pre-final inspection, which is done at the time that the remedy is deemed to be construction complete, which is not the site-wide measure, but remedy-wise, that's going to start the ONF clock. So then you have up to a year for what we call the shakedown period or ONF period, where minor modifications may be done to the remedy before it transfers to the state. So ONF at the last remedial action at the site can lag the construction completion determination. So the PCOR is site-wide and does not, ONF is not a criteria for construction completion. ONF is done on a remedy-specific basis and it's separate from the PCOR and may lag the PCOR for the last remedy.
Okay, great.
I hope that helped.
I think that definitely did. Thanks. Is anybody on the telephone lines has a question? You can unmute your phone lines and feel free to speak up. Remember, it's #6. Okay, I don't hear anybody on the phone lines, and I don't see anything else electronically. Again, you guys can continue to type up those comments and questions at any point, and we'll keep taking them, and then we'll make sure we stop before we close everything out to try to address any other questions. So, Kate, feel free to carry on.
Okay, well, this is actually Nancy, and we are switching gears to Chapter 5, the deletions and partial deletions. So let's move on to slide 71. And so this section is going to cover the deletion regulatory and policy requirements, as well as both the two-step and the direct Federal Register process. So moving on to slide 72. What is new in this guidance under this chapter? We've combined the deletion and partial deletion into one chapter. We removed the partial deletion GPS mapping requirement. We're discussing deletion notices and provide links to deletion notice templates. We describe the headquarters concurrence and deletion for deletions and partial deletions. We talk about the electronic deletion docket requirements and outline traditional, and so that's the two-part, and the direct Federal Register rulemaking processes. So that's what's new. All right, so moving on to slide 73, what is a deletion? Deletion is the removal of a site or a portion of the site from the national priority list. Deletion of a site or a portion of a site from the national priority list does not preclude eligibility for subsequent fund, financed, or responsible party actions. If conditions warrant, the national contingency plan provides that remedial actions may be taken at deleted sites. Additional enforcement actions may also be taken. Deletion does not affect cost recovery. Moving on to slide 74, the deletion process generally begins at most sites when the FCOR is signed, that's the final closeout report that Kate was just talking about, and the deletion requirements include the documentation of activities and decision-making at the site is completed. The activities conducted and documented are verified The public has had an opportunity for notice and comment before the site is formally deleted from the national priority list, and the state agrees with the deletion and has provided a concurrence letter. Slide 75. Partial deletions came out in 95. We came out with a rule November 1st, 1995, in a Federal Register publication is where you can find the partial deletion rule. It provided that EPA may delete portions of national priority list sites provided that the deletion criteria are met for those portions. And portions can be media, so it can be either groundwater or soil, or it can be divided geographically. But they have to be clearly delineated in the deletion documents. Deletion action does not interrupt ongoing removal and remedial activities at other portions of the site. So, you know, if you're deleting the soil, because all the soil excavation and disposal has taken place, it shouldn't interrupt any of the ongoing groundwater remediation that's happening. So moving on to slide 76, deletion criteria. The National Contingency Plan states the site may be deleted from the National Priority List when no response or no further response is appropriate. EPA must consult with the state in making this determination. And this is true for the partial deletions as well. So slide 76. Continuing on with deletion criteria, EPA must determine in consultation with the state that one of the following criteria have been met. Either the responsible or other parties have implemented all appropriate response actions required, all appropriate fund finance response under CERCLA has been implemented, and no further response action by responsible parties is appropriate, or the remedial investigation has shown that the release poses no significant threat to the public health or the environment, and therefore taking remedial measures is no longer appropriate. Slide 78. Deletion policy for RCRA deferral. In March 20th, 1995, we published this policy, which allows for deletion based upon deferral to the Resource Conservation Recovery Program. The purpose of this policy was to avoid duplication of effort and the need for an owner or operator to follow more than one set of regulatory procedures. Then in November of 1997, November 24th specifically, 1997, we amended this policy to make it applicable to federal facility sites. So this slide includes both of those Federal Register numbers specifically, if anybody needs to look those up. Moving on to slide 79. So criteria for our deletion based on RCRA deferral are outlined in that policy, and it's basically that the CERCLA site currently being addressed by the RCRA corrective action authorities are under an existing enforceable order or permit containing corrective action provisions. Response under the RCRA program is progressing adequately, and deletion would not disrupt any of the ongoing CERCLA response actions. So if all those criteria are met, then they can proceed. Deletion document preparation is on this next slide, slide 80. And this is applicable to both full deletions and partial deletions. So we'll get into that slide 81. The deletion process includes obtaining a letter of concurrence from the state, compiling a deletion docket, we're going to get into what's in a docket momentarily, preparing deletion notices, and obtaining headquarters review and concurrence. We're going to talk about all those individually. So the next slide, slide 82, state concurrence. The state is not in agreement that deletion cannot proceed. The state is given 30 days to comment on a draft deletion notices before publication. Slide 83. Once you have the state concurrence, then you need to start looking at all of your site documents to prepare your deletion docket. And you want to have, you know, all the pertinent information which supports your deletion recommendation in that docket. The documents in the administrative record can be referenced. Deletion docket should be available in the EPA regional office as well as local repositories, and it also needs to be uploaded into the electronic federal docket management system. And the reason for that is because there is a public side to that, regulations.gov. So once information is uploaded into that federal docket management system, then the public at large has access to look at it and you know, provide comments if they see fit. Moving on to the next slide, slide 84, we get into the specifics about the types of documents that you want to include in the docket, which would be the final closeout report, state concurrence letter, and an index of the administrative record. For a partial deletion, you wouldn't have a final closeout report, but you would want to include if there's a no action ROD, or an RA report for the parcels that are being proposed for deletion, a map that clearly delineates the boundaries of the parcels so you can really show, you know, what is being deleted and what's going to remain on the national priority list. Again, state concurrence letter and the administrative record index referencing all the pertinent documents. Slide 85. Next, we're going to talk about the rulemaking process. As I mentioned previously, there's two different ways that you can go about it. You can either do the traditional process, which is two-step rulemaking, or you can do the direct final rulemaking process. And we're going to talk about both of those individually. So if you go to page 86, we have a link provided on that slide for which gives you templates for both of these documents, for both the full deletion and partial deletion, for both kinds, the traditional two-step and for the direct final. All of those templates can be found through that link. Slide 87. What all goes into the two-step rulemaking process is the preparation of a notice of intent to delete, obtaining headquarters concurrence, publishing the notice of intent to delete and the local notice in local newspapers, receiving comments and preparing a responsive summary, and then preparing and publishing the notice of deletion. And we're going to get into each of these individually. So in the notice of slide 88, the notice of intent to delete contains the EPA regional staff contacts, typically provides for a 30-day public comment period. It includes deletion criteria. It should include site-specific information that you cut and paste directly from the F-Corps. So that's the reason why, as Kate was talking about previously, it's important for that F-Corps to, you know, really have gone through headquarters review, even though it doesn't require that, you know, official concurrence or informal concurrence like the P Corps. It still is good to coordinate with your headquarters regional coordinator and the deletions lead, because if the F Corps is in good shape, then you can do a lot of cutting and pasting in this particular section from the F Corps directly into your document, to your notice of intent to delete document. And then the notice of intent to delete does go to headquarters for review. And as Kate mentioned, slide 87, there is actually a requirement. There was a delegation revision that came out August 1st of 2008 that requires formal concurrence for all national priority list site deletions and partial deletions before the regional administrator can sign the notice of intent. And there is a memo that outlines this that came out September 12th, 2008, that kind of goes through the headquarters deletion review and concurrence process. And we're going to actually talk about that process in these next few slides. So slide 90, the headquarters regional coordinator and the headquarters deletion lead, which happens to be myself, provides comments on the draft notice of intent to delete. So remedial project managers would send their draft notice to me and to the appropriate regional coordinator, and the two of us will coordinate our comments and send you back one set of comments. And you know, once the region and the headquarters, meaning myself and the regional coordinator, resolve all the issues with all the comments and everybody's good with the document, then I would, as the deletions lead, go through a concurrence checklist where I basically verify that all the decision documents have been finalized, that the institutional controls have been recorded and implemented as necessary, that the five-year review and any of the environmental indicators support the deletion, that the F-Corps has been completed, that all the deletion documents have been uploaded into the FDMS system that I mentioned. Once all that has been done, then the package goes to our office director for him to sign a concurrence memorandum. Slide 91. After we send out the signed headquarters memo, concurrence memo, then the region can route their notice to their RA, their regional administrator, for signature, and then the signed package can be prepared for Federal Register publication. So the Federal Register office requires three hard copies. This is a change. They're used to require four, but currently now they're down to just needing three copies. The copies should be single-sided and double-spaced. The reason for the three copies are two actually the Federal Register office needs, and one goes to the EPA Federal Register team editor's file copy. So that's the reason for the three. Then they also need to provide a disk, or rather a CD containing an electronic version of the Federal Register notice. Typically, the document is published 3 business days after the receipt of the deletion package. Documents will appear on the public inspection website the day before the document is to be published. So don't be surprised by that. But, you know, even though, you know, 3 days is what is typical, after 2 days, you will see it online on the public inspection website. So you just need to be prepared for that. If you go to slide 92, then we have, I've provided you the website to get all the how-tos and Federal Register tips and the forms that you need for Federal Register publication. And, you know, if you're, you know, have a site that looks like you're, you know, getting ready for this process, you may want to check this site periodically, because I have been told by the Federal Register team that they're making updates, and they hope at one point to be able to provide a means for things to be submitted electronically, so, you know, there wouldn't even be the need to send the hard copies, but that's all in the works. So right now, check the website and look for any updates to what the Federal Register requirements are. All right, moving on to slide 93. Back in the region, the community involvement coordinator should be preparing and distributing a notice to local newspapers regarding the notice of intent to delete. This notice should be published the same day that the notice goes out. So need to coordinate, have the community involvement coordinator coordinate with the RPM on that publication date. And then either the remedial project manager or the community involvement coordinator should notify the appropriate trustees about the deletion as well. All right, moving on to slide 94. If comments are received on the notice of intent, then the region has to prepare a responsive summary, which would go, you know, for local comment and national comment. The responsive summary presents detailed responses to any of the comments received. They should send a draft to headquarters for review and comment, and a copy of this summary, which has been approved by the RA, would then be added to the deletion docket. On page 95, or slide 95, if the deletion is still appropriate, then the notice to delete is prepared and should contain the effective date of the deletion action. The document is again sent to headquarters review and goes through that same process that I mentioned before. The notice of deletion would be signed by the RA again, and that package would be sent to the Federal Register. Again, same package requirements as before, and same publication deadlines, the 3 days, all that stuff. So then on slide 96, the direct deletion process it differs because you prepare the notice of intent and the notice to delete at the same time. You send them both to headquarters at the same time and get review and concurrence at the same time. And then they're both published at the same time. If there's adverse comments, though, then you have to do a withdrawal and then prepare the responsive summary before publishing the notice to delete. And we're going to talk about that on the next slide a little bit, how that looks. So we've got kind of a little schematic here on slide 97. So if you do the direct process, you submit them both at the same time, but during that 30-day period, you receive adverse comments. Then you, before the 60 days is up, you have to quickly send in a withdrawal notice, which basically takes back the notice of deletion before the effective date occurs, and prepare a responsive summary to address the comments and put it in the docket, and then you would start over with preparing the notice to delete at that point if it's still appropriate. So the direct process can be an expedited process and take less time unless you end up having adverse comments and you have to do a withdrawal. Then it could actually, you know, make the process take longer than the regular two-step process would have. So when trying to decide whether to do the two-step traditional process or the direct process, you need to think about whether the site has had a lot of community interest, if there is a lot of potential for adverse comments, if there's been, you know, controversy, or whether it's a site that has not, you know, had any particular community interest at all, then that, and the site has gone smoothly, and all the 5-year reviews, you know, all the people interviewed have always, you know, not had any issues, and that might be a candidate that you need to kind of take that into consideration. Moving on to slide 98. So preparing the notice of intent and the notice of deletion, basically the notice of intent is the document that's soliciting public comment, and the notice of deletion will contain the effective deletion date, which is typically 60 days after the publication date when you use this direct process, again, unless there's adverse comments. Both documents, again, are sent to headquarters for review and comment, and headquarters concurrence procedure is at the same time. I'm moving on to slide 99. The regional administrator would sign both notices at the same time. Two separate deletion packages would be prepared, one for each of the notices, and the notices are published on the same day in the Federal Register, as I mentioned. And again, if there's no adverse comments, then the deletion would become effective on the date in the direct notice of deletion, which would be that 60 days. Slide number 100. Withdrawal of a direct notice of deletion is required if adverse comments are received. As we've discussed, templates are available on the website. Again, so an example of a withdrawal, if that's necessary, you can pull that off of the website. The withdrawal also has to be signed by the regional administrator. That withdrawal package contents are the same as the deletion package that we discussed before. And it must be published before the effective date that was specified in that original notice of deletion. So you would prepare a responsive summary and send it again to me, to the deletion lead, for review. Slide 101, if the deletion action is still appropriate, then you prepare a notice of deletion, which would be the same template as that two-step rulemaking notice of deletion. A second comment period is not necessary at this point because you've already addressed all the comments, and you just prepare and publish the notice of deletion consistent with that two-step rulemaking process. So slide 102 is our final question slide. Jean, do we have any questions?
It doesn't look like we have, we do have a question that came in from Richland, Washington, and they want to know, when we're talking about deletion, when your deletion is based on deferral to RCRA, could that also include deferring to an established NEPA action?
No. The deferral policy was specific to RCRA.
Okay, great. And our next question comes in from Boston, Massachusetts, and they ask, do you need to have an ESD finalized and signed before I can send the NOID and NOD to headquarters for their review and comment?
I apologize.
It's okay. He has a clarifying statement here that the state is currently reviewing the draft ESD and is the last reviewer.
Oh, okay. You can go ahead and send it to me to start reviewing, but you need to let me know that that's the case. And so that way it'd be better for me to, give my kind of informal approval once it is signed. But I could go ahead and start reviewing it, and so could the headquarters regional coordinator, be giving you our initial thoughts. But we wouldn't be able to actually start preparing, the package for our office director to do formal concurrence or anything like that yet. But we could start reviewing it.
Okay. And I don't see any other questions online, so let's go ahead and quickly turn to our telephone line. If anybody is on the telephone line and has a question, remember you simply hit #6 and feel free to speak up and ask your question. Okay, I don't hear anybody coming in on the phone line. So since we are just past our scheduled end time, let me see if Kate or Nancy have any closing statements or comments you'd like to make.
Kate, do you have any?
The only thing I would say is, can you go to the next slide, Nancy?
Mm-hmm.
We have some on slide 103, and can you click and see 104?
On slide 103 and 104, 103 has some helpful links to the guidance that we, this whole thing's based on, and also our branch has a post-construction completion website that has, I know we use words like long-term response action, LCRA, ONF, five-year reviews that are all post-construction completion activities but weren't within the scope of this guidance. That website has guidance on those things. And then we also, again, we touched on remedial action, but we have, as you could imagine, a lot of guidance on design and construction. So there's also a link to that. And then Nancy, my contact information and phone number, and Nancy's contact information and phone number. So if there's a question that was confusing, or I guess something that was confusing that you couldn't get clarified through a question, we're happy to answer it if you want to shoot us an email or call us. That's all I got.
All right, especially if you have anything site-specific.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, with that, I think I'm going to go ahead and move everybody along to slide number 105 to start closing out today's seminar. First, I also want to echo Kate and Nancy's thanks to the over 70 people who actually joined us from all over the country for today's Internet seminar. And I also appreciate Kate and Nancy joining us to deliver today's presentation. On slide 105, we have some helpful reminders in terms of how to get copies of the presentation material and other resources, as well as how you can submit feedback. Again, I'll refer everybody back to the seminar homepage that, again, you would have seen when you signed up for today's session. There are links and buttons referencing the additional resources or links where you can download a copy of today's presentation materials. And there's also going to be a link or button to a short feedback form. Those should be hyperlinked on slide number 105 for those of you that have an electronic copy. I would ask that you take just a moment to fill out that short feedback form. When you fill that form out, it will display information, including your name, contact information, and email address. It also gives you the option to request confirmation of your participation today. While we don't necessarily issue certificates for attending today's session, if you fill out the feedback form and check that box and correctly enter your email address on that form, we will send an email confirmation that will at least verify that you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you take that confirmation message along with your registration and a copy of the presentation materials, you may be able to earn credit for attending today's seminar for your accrediting institution. I can't stress that enough. Please make sure that your email address is entered correctly. And I want to thank you in advance for taking just a moment to fill out that form. If you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, then we rely upon feedback to help us to continue to improve and deliver sessions like this. As Kate mentioned earlier, if you have specific things you'd like to see, requests, and I think there was a request about a crosswalk in terminology between DOD and EPA terms, you can also include those types of comments in the feedback, and we'll be sure to pass that along to the presenters. We'll go ahead and move everybody along to slide number 106, and that's just a reminder that we do online training like this through the Kluwin website all throughout the calendar year. So if you're interested in participating in the future deliveries, I'd encourage you to take a look at our training calendar at kluwin.org, or you can also feel free to connect with us on popular professional and social networking sites like Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. So again, with that, I want to thank everybody who joined us for today's seminar. And I hope that this was a valuable expenditure of your time and that we will either see you or hear from you on a future delivery of our Internet Seminar Series. When the recording for today's seminar is available for free replay and download, you will automatically receive an email from me, and you can feel free to forward that on to anyone who will find this useful. Thanks again, and this will be the formal conclusion for today's Internet Seminar.